for U.S. companies to invest in the U.S. while facilitating the investment of foreign companies, particularly Japanese companies, in the U.S. market. Now, you know, whether it's conscious or not, that's the result of the tax code, and that is, in fact, an industrial policy. So the truth is that we do have an industrial policy, it's just that we don't have one that makes any sense. In 1984, the U.S.-Japan Businessmen's Council did a report on Japanese industrial policy and American industrial policy. The conclusion of the report was that Japan has an industrial policy, that it's comprehensive, coordinated, effective, and a major factor in Japan's success. That the United States does not have a policy, but that it has policies. That they are ad hoc, uncoordinated, often contradictory, and not very effective. And I'll never forget the press conference at which that report was made public. And at the press conference, one of the reporters there asked the American chairman of that group, who also at that time was the chairman of a Fortune 500 company, whether or not he didn't think the United States should have an industrial policy in light of his own report. And the response was, nope, no siree, Bob, we don't want government picking winners and losers in this country. Get government off the back of industry. And the reporter persevered. He said, well, wait a minute, Mr. Chairman. He said, I don't mean that we have to have big subsidies. I don't mean that we need to have these tripartite boards that the Democratic Party is talking about, you know, industry and management, labor, and government representatives. But he said, your own report says that we have these policies, that they're ad hoc, uncoordinated, and contradictory. Wouldn't it make sense at least to coordinate the policies that we have? And the response was, nope, no siree, Bob, we don't want government interfering in business. Well, the truth is government does interfere in business. And if it's going to do so, it ought at least to do so in a coordinated, responsible way aimed at facilitating business rather than at making life more difficult. Now, a second piece of our puzzle has to do with the business environment in which we operate. And it has two pieces to it. One piece is the environment that is established by the public. The other piece is the environment that is established by the values and the thinking of business leaders. Let's talk first about the public. We hear a great deal about the long-term view of European and particularly Japanese businessmen. We hear how American businessmen are only interested in the short term, only interested in quarterly profit reports. And there's some truth in that. But let's look at why that might be. The implication in the criticism always is that there is something morally wrong with American businessmen, that they are personally short-sighted and greedy, and if they would simply become better citizens, this problem would be solved. It's much deeper than that. Let me give you an example. Between 1985 and 1987, the Japanese semiconductor industry had cumulative losses of $4 billion. In that same period of time, the U.S. industry had cumulative losses of about $2 billion. Now, in the United States, about 7 companies left the business altogether. 30,000 people were laid off and lost their jobs. The capital spending, the R&D spending of most of the companies was cut way back. And the share prices of all those companies fell precipitately. In Japan, not a single company left the business. In fact, 2 new companies came into the business. Not a single worker lost his job. Capital spending was increased by 40%. In the face of a $4 billion loss, plant and equipment was increased by 40%. R&D spending was raised by 2 percentage points, and the share prices of all the companies rose. Now, I contend if you can take a $4 billion loss and watch your share price go up, it's not too hard to take the long-term view. And conversely, be you ever so far-sighted yourself personally, when you're operating in a situation in which you're laying off your employees, closing your plants, and watching your share price drop, it's very difficult not to give some thought to what's going to happen tomorrow. The fact of the matter is that we have created in the United States a very short-term oriented environment. The Securities and Exchange Commission requires a quarterly report. In Japan, there's no quarterly report. In response to that quarterly report, a company may report that its earnings are down for a quarter. And in response to that, the shares begin to trade. Now, who trades those shares? Well, those are money market managers on Wall Street. They themselves are paid bonuses on the basis of their quarterly trading profits. And as a result of that trading, the share prices may tend to fall. And when the share prices fall, the cost of capital, the cost of investment, the risk of investment automatically rises. And as it does so, the threat of takeover, the threat of tender offers increases dramatically. Now, in Japan, in Korea, in Germany, there's no such problem. There are no quarterly reports. 70% of the shares listed on the Tokyo Exchange never change hands. They're in friendly hands. Take a company like Toyota. If you look at Toyota's annual report, it looks to be a company of about $60 billion in sales, about half the size of General Motors. And you look at that and you say, wow, these Toyota executives are really fantastic. They have a company half the size of General Motors and they're beating the pants off of General Motors. Those American managers must be real bums. But if you look a little bit more closely, you'll see something else. You see that Toyota controls most of its suppliers. Nominally, these suppliers are independent companies. But as a practical matter, their only customer is Toyota. And Toyota will inevitably own 20%, 25% of them and have people on their boards. Beyond that, Toyota is part of the Mitsui Group in Japan. What is the Mitsui Group? Well, it's a grouping of about 400 companies, total assets of about $800 billion. Toyota is part of the Mitsui Group, which means that when its shares are traded, most of those shares are held by other group companies. They're not going to change hands. There's not going to be any Carl Icahn or T-Boone Pickens in Japan. In fact, Toyota is not a $60 billion company. It's more like an $800 billion company, because it has the power of those resources behind it. Let me give an example of what that really means in practical terms. During the height of the semiconductor wars, I went to Japan and met with Mr. Kawanishi, the head of Toshiba's semiconductor operations. I said to him, Kawanishi-san, how do you do it? Here you are, I calculate Toshiba is losing $400 or $500 million in semiconductors, and you've just announced a big new plant. Now, you have a board of directors. You must have to make some kind of capital request to your board of directors. How do you get them to approve that? Do you do a discounted cash flow? Do you do return on assets? What do you do? And Kawanishi smiled. He said, no, Clyde-san. He said, we don't have any MBAs in our company. He said, we're all engineers here. We don't do any of that MBA nonsense. He said, look, our group, not our company, not Toshiba, not our company, our group thinks that semiconductors are absolutely fundamental. Our group is in computing, in telecommunications, in consumer electronics, and semiconductors are the basis of all those businesses. He said, our group is going to remain in semiconductors regardless. And so he said, I make $500 million loss this year, but I'll get it back next year. He said, my objective is to stay in semiconductors. I look at what Fujitsu is doing. I look at what Mitsubishi Electric is doing. I have to maintain my market share. I invest accordingly. Now, that is a very, very different approach to business decisions, capital investment decisions, marketing decisions, risk analysis, than anything that you would find in an American company. But it is made possible by the fact that Toshiba is not a standalone company. Toshiba is part of a group. Or take a company like NEC. NEC, on paper, looks like a $20 billion company. It's a company that's very similar to Motorola in its product offering and in its technologies. And very often it's compared to Motorola. But the big difference is that Toshiba is part of the Sumitomo Group. The top executives of the 21 leading Sumitomo Group companies, including NEC, Mazda, Sumitomo Electric, Sumitomo Trading, Sumitomo Bank, 21 of them, have what is known as a Hakusuikai, the White Water Club, which meets one Wednesday a month in downtown Tokyo. And they meet to talk about a range of issues. They talk about group strategy. They may talk about contributing money to a PAC in the United States, or placing a plant in order to neutralize a hostile congressman in the U.S. Congress, or launching a satellite to handle worldwide group communications. Tremendous worldwide power of this group. But to get an idea of the power of that kind of an organization, imagine a similar American organization. Imagine that John Reed, the chairman of Citibank, would call a meeting of the Citibank Club. And let's imagine that Citibank was the lead shareholder in 21 major American companies. Let's say IBM, General Motors, Hewlett-Packard, FMC, companies of that ilk. Let's suppose that they all own shares in each other. Citibank was the lead shareholder and the lead bank, and John Reed calls a meeting once a month of the 21 chief executives of those companies to meet at some posh watering hole in Manhattan to discuss group strategy. Well, of course it would never happen. The Justice Department would have a heart attack first, and if it didn't, the corporate counsel of those companies would. But do you think that kind of a group would be able to compete? Would it be able to take the long-term view? Would it be able to invest and absorb short-term losses to achieve long-term market share? Well, of course it would. Certainly more so than any individual company. Certainly better than a Motorola can by itself up against an NEC linked with the Sumitomo Group. So we have created in the United States an environment which forces us to take a short-term view. And our competitors in Japan and Korea and Germany and elsewhere have created an environment which is more insulated, which enables investors to take a longer-term view, which reduces volatility and risk. Now, there's a second piece of that, and this is what I call the internal environment, and it's best expressed by a story that appeared recently in the New York Times. The story was an interview with the chairman of the Security Pacific Bank, one of California's largest. And it was a story about the growing alliance between Security Pacific and Mitsui Bank. And the chairman of Security Pacific waxed eloquent about the advantages of this alliance with Mitsui. And he talked about the increased capitalization that some of the Security Pacific subsidiaries in the U.S. could achieve. He talked about being able to get a window on Japan in the Pacific through the Mitsui relationship. But the punchline was at the end of the story. In the last paragraph of the story, he said, "Of course, Security Pacific is not necessarily forever." He said, "My job as the chief executive is to achieve the highest possible return for my shareholders." And he said, if somebody, and reading between the lines, you could hear, hint, hint, Mitsui, were to make an offer to buy us, well, of course, we'd have to consider that. Now, it is inconceivable that the chairman of the Mitsui Bank would say something like that. Because if the chairman of Security Pacific thinks that Security Pacific is not forever, while the chairman of Mitsui thinks that Mitsui is forever, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And in fact, this is something that's been happening for 30 years in American industry. We teach our students in business school portfolio management. We teach them that their job is to achieve a high return for shareholders, and that it doesn't matter how they do that, so that if they are in one business and it's not very profitable, the smart thing is to get out of that business and into something else that's more profitable. Many of you have heard of the Boston Consulting Group's quadrant. You know, you have cash cows and stars and question marks and dogs. And if you're a corporate manager, you look at your portfolio of products, and the idea is to get rid of the dogs and to milk the cash cows and to fund the question marks and the stars. And typically what happens is that corporations don't cut the dogs, and they don't milk the cash cow, and they don't fund the question marks and stars enough, and then they have to call the Boston Consulting Company to tell them how to do it. But the point is that the whole philosophy there is that you, as a manager, are shifting into and out of businesses. Now, what that means is that when the going gets tough, you'll get out of the business. And what that means is that a foreign competitor who understands that has an incentive to make the going tough. Because he knows if he makes the going tough, the Americans will get out of the business. And then pretty soon the Americans understand that, and so the game graduates to a second level. And the Americans then begin to look to see whether there's going to be any foreign competition, particularly Far Eastern competition, in a particular market. And if it is, they decide not to get into the market. They preempt themselves. And then pretty soon it graduates to a third level. The Far Eastern competition realizes that the Americans can be spooked. And so they engage in public relations. They make statements about the markets they might go into, knowing that by doing so they scare the Americans out of them. And so pretty soon the Americans are doing nothing. You know, they're not producing because they're going to be in services, but then they're not in services because they can't do that either. The bottom line is that we have an uncompetitive philosophy. If you believe that you're only in business for a little while, you probably will be. And that's not a competitive philosophy in today's world. Now, there's a final piece to this puzzle, and that is the piece that's most often discussed. This is the so-called trade deficit, the trade problem, unfair trade. Recently, I heard a good story. The story goes that the Iranians take three hostages. One is Japanese, one is French, one is American. Of course, they're sentenced to be shot, but in a burst of brotherly feeling, the Revolutionary Tribunal gives each hostage one last statement. First is the Frenchman, he says, "Vive la France," and bang, they shoot him. Next is the Japanese. He stands up and he says, "Now, please relax, this is going to take quite some time." And he opens his briefcase because he says he wants to give his entire lecture on Japanese management technique one last time. And immediately the American stands up and says, "No, no, no, please shoot me first. I don't want to hear any more about Japanese management techniques." And a friend of mine in Tokyo said, well, he said, that story in Japan has a different ending. He said, in Japan there are three hostages, Japanese, French, and American, sentenced to be shot. First is the Frenchman, bang, he's out. Vive la France, bang, he's out. And next is the American. And the American stands up and says, "Please relax, this is going to take quite some time." And he takes from his coat jacket a long list. He says he wants to read the entire list of unfair Japanese trade practices one more time. Japanese says, "No, shoot me first." Well, this discussion of trade is always taking place in terms of fairness and unfairness. And we accuse the Japanese and others. We accuse the Brazilians and the Indians and the Koreans and the Taiwanese. And recently we've been accusing the EC of cheating, of not opening their markets, of not providing full access. And their response to us is that we don't try hard enough. Now, the truth is that there are two fundamental problems at work here, neither of which is captured in the normal discussion. One is that the United States doesn't have a strategy. Because we do not have a domestic strategy, because we do not have a policy towards our industry, it's very difficult to have a meaningful trade policy. Let me explain what I mean. We send our trade representative, right now Ambassador Hills, abroad, and we instruct her to open foreign markets. And so she goes to our trading partners, and this is a little bit simplified, but essentially this is what happens. She goes to our trading partners and she says, "Please open your markets." And our trading partners say, "Okay, fine, Carla, which markets would you like us to open?" And her response is, "Well, all of them, of course." And then they respond and say, "Okay, okay, we know you Americans are idealistic, but which ones first? What are your priorities?" And we're stuck. We don't have any answer. We don't know whether we'd rather sell semiconductor chips or wood chips, whether we'd rather sell supercomputers or soybeans. As a nation, we don't know that. And so the result is that our trade agenda is made up by whoever walks in the door first. I'm sure many of you have wondered why we have spent so much time on items like aluminum baseball bats or beef or oranges in our trade negotiations with Japan. Or why we almost went to war with the EC earlier this year over animal offal, the total value of which was, I think, $100 million. Why do we do that? And the answer is because our trade agenda is determined by who has the best Washington lobby, who gets into to see the U.S. Trade Representative first, or even, by horror of horrors, those dreaded bureaucrats who may have particular interests in particular industries and put them on the agenda. The supercomputer issue is on the agenda because I, when I was at the Commerce Department, happened to have an interest in supercomputers. And so I put it on the agenda. But there is no analysis. There's no thought. We don't have a domestic strategy. Therefore, we cannot have an international strategy. And so we send our trade negotiator abroad to open markets. And we assume that everybody out there knows what open means. But they don't. Open is a term that grows out of America's history as an immigrant nation. We believe business should be done on the basis of the best offer. Not long-term relationships, not who you went to school with, not your fraternity brother, not the guy you've known for 30 years, but the best offer. And in an immigrant nation, it cannot be any other way. In an immigrant nation, if you don't do business on the basis of the best offer, if you only do business on the basis of who you've known all your life, you won't deal with newcomers. And if you don't deal with newcomers, you won't have any, and you won't be an immigrant nation. So our definition of open is based on the premise of dealing with newcomers and old-timers the same way. Take a nation like Japan. The Japanese always tell us we have to try harder. What do they mean by that? They mean we have to establish long-term relationships, because in Japan, business is done on the basis of long-term relationships. It's done precisely on the basis of who you went to school with, who your fraternity brother is, who you've done business with for a long time. In fact, in Japan, if you abandon a long-term loyal supplier, that's considered unfair. In the U.S., if I've been doing business with someone for 20 years and a new supplier comes along and offers me a better deal, I'm justified in switching suppliers. In fact, if I don't, I may be sued for discrimination. In Japan, if I switch, I'm considered unfair because I've abandoned my long-term loyal retainer, the guy who stuck with me through thick and thin. It's a different concept of what open and closed mean. It's a different concept of fair and unfair. And our efforts in this direction are a nonsense. We tell ourselves that we don't want to negotiate over concrete issues. But in negotiating for open, we put ourselves in a corner, because our trading partners don't understand the terms of the language that we're dealing with. And so the result is that we constantly find ourselves in situations in which our market is open relatively, foreign markets are relatively closed, and we accuse them of being fair or unfair, and we never sit down to negotiate actually selling them something. We spend all our time trying to carry out a social revolution in their countries. Now, the obvious question is, what do we do about all this? And the answer is, you have to read my book. But I'll give you a hint. I think that the solution is implicit in the analysis. If I could do one thing, just one thing, it would be to quadruple the American savings rate. We are a capitalist economy without capital. You can't run an economy that way. We need capital. We desperately need it. And if I could do one thing, it would be to do that. How do you do that? Well, it's not all that difficult, I don't think. We could solve our budget deficit problem and a big piece of our trade problem by simply imposing $1 a gallon tax on gasoline. Now, everyone will throw their hands up in horror, but that would leave us still paying for gasoline about 50% of what the rest of the world pays for gasoline. That would raise $100 billion right off the bat. We could stop writing off interest on mortgages on second homes. We can even cap the interest write-off on first homes at some reasonable number, $50,000, $75,000. Pick your number. We ought to stop taxing the interest that we earn on savings and dividends, and we ought to start taxing consumption. I think that we need an industrial policy. Government doesn't pick winners and losers. There's not a person in this room who doesn't know that in the next 20 years, the aerospace industry, biogenetics, telecommunications, semiconductors, artificial intelligence, We all know that those industries are the industry of the future. The government didn't pick that. No bureaucrat picked that. The market picked that. The question is, are there going to be Americans participating in those industries? Other nations have made those decisions and are actively pursuing policies to be sure that their companies are there. Japan is spending about $1 billion a year to ensure that its companies, which already dominate the television markets, will be the leaders in high-definition television. Recently, the U.S. government folded up its activity in the Commerce Department in support of high-definition television. The bureaucrats don't pick the winners, but they have a big impact on determining who's in the winner's circle. And it's not clear that the United States is going to be there. I think we need policies similar to Germany's and Japan's. Obviously, we need to rethink our concept of what a company is. A company is more than just return to shareholders. A company has constituencies other than the shareholders. It has employees. It has customers. It works and operates in communities. We need to think about what the real purpose of a company is. Our philosophy of the corporation is not competitive. We need to rethink that. We need to rethink the environment within which we make business operate. We need to look at maybe getting rid of quarterly reports. We could create two classes of shares. If you want to trade in and out every day, you're an A shareholder, but you have no vote. If you want to have a vote, you're a B shareholder, but you have to hold for 5 years to create a longer-term horizon for investment. There are many things of that nature that we could do. I think we need to have a trade strategy. I think it's nonsense to ask for open markets. I can negotiate anything concrete, a price, a market share, a sliding scale, an absolute amount, anything you can identify, I can negotiate. I can't negotiate open. I can't negotiate try hard. We don't have an accepted common definition of those terms. I don't know when I've achieved it. But there's something else that's much more important, which comes down to the theme of your conference here this morning. In 1980, before many of the events occurred that we've discussed this morning, Nikko Securities, a Japanese research company, did a report on the American economy. And after analyzing and predicting many of the trends that we've talked about here this morning, the report finished with a paragraph in which it talked about the rising crime rate, the deterioration of education, the lack of social discipline in the United States, and it used the term social ill, and it said unless the social ills of the United States are understood to their root, we cannot understand accurately or adequately the future of the American economy. Now, how true that is. You know, we have apotheosized in our mythology the cowboy. The lone rider rides in from the plains, shoots up all the baddies, and rides off into the sunset. Think of the imagery of the last 4 or 5 years. We've talked about America is back, standing tall. Where does standing tall come from? It's the cowboy rhetoric. Cowboys stand tall. America's back. The great rugged individualist. But what we forget is that it was the settlers who won the West. Now in film, of course, the settlers aren't too spectacular. They dress like hicks. They worry a lot. They're slow on the draw. They move slowly, burdened down with chickens and oxen, and wagons and grandma. But they move together. When the wagon wheels break, they stop and they fix them together. When the Indians attack, they circle the wagons and they fight together. Cowboys are all gone. You only see them on film. Settlers are still here. A nation that pays new minted MBAs 10 or 20 times what it pays veteran teachers. A nation in which the president does not control the streets of the Capitol at night. A nation that thinks that producers have no stake in the welfare of labor. that labor has no identity with the interests of the corporation in which it works, that consumers have no stake in the welfare of producers, a nation that thinks that the proper relationship between management and labor is adversarial, that in fact writes that adversarial code into its law, a nation that thinks that the proper relationship between government and industry is arm's length, adversarial, a nation that mortgages the future of its kids, that allows drug kings to control the streets of its major cities, is a nation in trouble. And I can give you all of the prescriptions. I can tell you about taxes, trade policy, industrial policy, corporate governance. I can give you all the prescriptions. And it won't make a single bit of difference. Because the problem is an illness of the spirit. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of Father Ritter. Father Ritter is a Catholic priest in New York City. He runs an organization called Covenant House. And his task is to care for runaway children in the streets of New York. He takes in every year about 15,000 kids who are living in the streets of New York City. He promises them 3 square meals a day and a bed. He came once to the city where I was living at the time, New Canaan, Connecticut, to talk about his organization. Those of you who know Connecticut and know New Canaan know that there is no more establishment kind of a bedroom community than New Canaan, Connecticut, and nothing is more establishment than the Episcopal Church in New Canaan. And Ritter spoke at the Episcopal Church, and it was interesting, the contrast. Ritter went down there, and the church has 3 priests. They're all tall, good-looking guys, immaculately gowned. They all have deep, booming, sonorous voices that resonate in the acoustics of the cathedral there. And they gave eloquent prayers, and then Ritter was introduced to speak. Now, he's just a little guy. He's got kind of a squeaky voice. He's got an old wrinkled gown. He's not impressive at all to look at. But the contrast was incredible. Ritter had power. He had the power of conviction. He talked simply, but he moved the audience, because he believed what he said. And I'll never forget the question and answer period. At one point, someone raised their hand and said to him, Father Ritter, Ritter had described the pornography industry in New York, and he had said it's about a $6 billion a year industry. Someone raised their hand and said to him, Father Ritter, why do we have that? What can we do to stop it? And Ritter said very simply, we have it because we want it. He said, bottom line, we have it because we want it. We tolerate it because we want it. Ladies and gentlemen, we're in the situation that we're in today, a declining country internationally, a deteriorating standard of living, deteriorating infrastructure, deteriorating security in our neighborhoods. I dare say many of the people in this room have recently installed security systems in their homes, and if you don't have them, you probably will in the future. We are in a deteriorating situation. And we're in it basically because we want it. Because we have not achieved consensus out of our diversity. We've forgotten the lesson of the pioneers and the settlers. We're all trying to be cowboys. We're not working together. And the interesting thing is, people say to me, does America have to be like Japan? Can America be like Japan? And the answer is absolutely not. America can't be like Japan, and it wouldn't want to be like Japan. And we don't have to look to Japan for the answer. The answer was given to us at the very founding of the Republic. The signing of the Declaration of Independence, July 4, 1776. You remember what Ben Franklin said? Franklin said, now we must all hang together, for if we do not, assuredly, we shall all hang separately. Those words are just as true today in 1989 as they were in 1776. Thank you very much.